This is the Morrow Midday Show.
But wait, there's more.
On ESPN Radio.
Guess who's back, 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 back again. Shady's back, back, back. Tell a friend. Guess who's back, 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 guess who's back.
Final hour of the Morrow Midday Show with Luke Morrow here on ESPN Radio. The Morrow Midday Show is brought to you by Baker Roofing. They have been in business for over 100 years. They're one of the largest, most recognized roofing contractors in the U.S., and they provide residential and commercial roofing. In 1915, Baker Roofing Company was founded on the promise of always good work. So give our friend Matt Johnson, general manager at Baker Roofing Charleston, a call, or head on over to bakerroofing.com for more information. You can also check out their incredible history and see all the different roofing types that are available online at bakerroofing.com. Over 100 years of always good work, Baker Roofing, bringing you the Morrow Midday Show each and every day. If you ever miss anything from the show, you can always catch it on demand. Just search ESPN Radio Charleston, however you listen to your podcasts. You can also find the podcast available online at charlestonsportsradio.com or through our free app. Search ESPN Charleston in the App Store. And you can always get in touch with the show online at Morrow Middays on Twitter, at Morrow Middays, M-A-U-R-O. Online at charlestonsportsradio.com, click on our show page, and there you can leave a comment for the show. You can always text the show, 843-608-1734. Or give us a call, 843-721-9500. We'll have the Citadel basketball tonight against Manhattan. The Citadel lost yesterday. South Carolina State beat them by 17. So this great run here for SC State continues with all the things going their way lately. And specifically basketball, they've won 5 of their last 6. They've played much better under their first-year head coach. And so they'll play Charleston Southern tonight at 5 o'clock. And then the Citadel will play Manhattan in the second game. Manhattan beat Charleston Southern, beat them up pretty good last night, scored 99 points. And Manhattan typically is a pretty good program. They're 7-3 this year. They got a lot of size, so that'll be a tough game for the Citadel tonight. The Bulldogs, they didn't play well yesterday. You know, last Thursday was their first game in 10 days after the exams, and they came out and they played pretty good. You would have thought that the way they played last night was the first game after a long layoff. Didn't shoot it well, had 19 turnovers, season-low number of points. They were just off. It just wasn't their night. And it's good and bad that you bounce back the next day, right? It's good because you could put last night's performance behind you, come back and play right away against Manhattan, try to bounce back. It's like a baseball team. You lose a game, oh, don't worry. That's just the first of a 7-game homestand, right? We're playing the next 6 days. A reliever blows a game. Okay, we'll come back to you tomorrow. And maybe just put it behind you. But then the bad side is, well, you did just play a game yesterday, and now you have to try to bounce back the next day and play 2 games in about 28 hours here, and it's against Manhattan, so we don't have as much time to prepare or get ready or even rest up. But that's what's on tap for the Citadel tonight. Now, it's a tournament, so that second game will tip off about 30 minutes after the conclusion of the first game. So they say 7 o'clock, but the first game's at 5, and, you know, games typically, college basketball, it's about 2 hours. So it could be closer to 7:30. Whenever they tip off, we'll have the coverage for you over on our sister station, The City. And pregame, the coverage will begin 30 minutes before tip-off, therefore, once that first game ends. So if you are interested in listening on the radio tonight, tip-off is scheduled for 7. It will be anywhere between 7 and 7:30, I would imagine. And then, you know, you get overtime maybe in that first game, and you're pushing it closer towards 8. And we'll be on the air 30 minutes before tip-off, so I would guess somewhere between 6:30 and 7 we'll actually hit the air and get ready for that game tonight. So a little bit of a programming note, just in case you're curious, or we're hoping to listen to the game, or even come out to the game. If you're coming out tonight and only for that Citadel-Manhattan game, keep that in mind. It'll be 30 minutes after the first game, so they may not actually start until closer to about 7:30. But regardless, whenever they play that game, we'll have it for you over on The City. And the Citadel will try to bounce back. Final non-conference game. And then conference play begins next week in the Southern Conference. No losing teams right now. Everybody in the Southern Conference is at least 500 or better. Not a single team with a losing record so far. So the conference play will become very competitive in the SoCon. But let me circle back to this, how we started the afternoon, talking about that doubleheader last night for Monday Night Football. Now, just as a little bit of a sidebar, I think that should be the norm. I've said this going back to last year, we had some doubleheaders on Monday Night Football for the pandemic. I think first and foremost, all year long, let's do a Monday Night Football doubleheader. 5 o'clock, 8:30, or 5:30, 9 o'clock, something like that. Now, if you're on the West Coast, sorry, feel bad for you, and we do have listeners all over the country. Right now, you're talking about a 2 o'clock kickoff on a Monday. You know, that's a little difficult. It's like what college football is doing on New Year's Eve this year at the playoff. What? Not only on New Year's Eve, but the first game's kicking off at, what, 3:30? So that's 12:30 out in the West Coast. People still do have to work on New Year's Eve. On the East Coast, you're still working at 3:30, right, around here. Maybe you cut out early because it's New Year's Eve, but a lot of people will be working until 5. What are you doing? How is that good for the game? So I understand for the NFL, maybe you wouldn't want to have a Monday night doubleheader with one of the games kicking off at 2 o'clock West Coast time. But statistically, also two-thirds of the sports viewers are in the Eastern time zone, and the there's more money to be made in the Eastern time zone. That's why the games are usually based around Eastern time. But that's all besides the point. I think we should have doubleheaders on Monday Night Football regardless every week during a season. And I also think this time of year, once you get to the holidays and people are home more and you got family over and you're getting ready for the holidays, you're not going out as much. You have to wrap the presents. You got to stuff the stockings. You got to get your Christmas meals ready. You know, family's coming over. You got to entertain. We should have football like this for the NFL. I know we have the bowl games. And I'll watch a random bowl game, but it's a little bit different when you have NFL games that really mean something and that have playoff implications. We have two more games tonight. I can't wait. I mean, I got Citadel Manhattan tonight, but we also have two football games going on, and they're both big games for the playoff seeding. These aren't just a couple of random teams playing. Even last night, Browns Raiders big for the wild card. The Bears aren't in it, but the Vikings needed to win last night to stay in the wild card hunt. So you're not just giving me random games. We're getting games that are important for the playoff window. And I think moving forward, this should become the new norm, that these 2 weeks, around Christmas and New Year's, people are home more, you got family over, the kids are home from school. Give me more games. Give me a football game on a Tuesday. Take Wednesday off. That's fine. You know, and then Thursday, Saturdays become the norm this time of year. Give me a Friday game. Why not? And sure, it hurts the Sunday afternoon, but, you know, that's okay. Spread it out a little bit. And then it's going to really take some coordination so that teams aren't constantly playing on short weeks. Well, let's get some NFL games almost every day of the week for just these 2 weeks. Maybe throw in an extra bye week for these teams. It's a longer season now, and that helps coordinate. You play on a Tuesday, but then you get the next weekend off, and then you play the following week, however you want to coordinate it. I like this. I think it should be the new norm. I'm looking forward to the games tonight. Now, last night's games were another reminder that this time of year, it's not about winning pretty. See, that's the difference between college football and the NFL. College football, they ask you, did you win? And then the follow-up is, how much? In the NFL, we don't ask that. It's the league of ultimate parity. You understand that one week the Cardinals can lose the Lions, another week they can beat the Rams. It doesn't make any sense, but that's the NFL, any given Sunday. And at the end of the year, it's simply based off of wins and losses, not how much you win, you won and lost by. It's not some sort of beauty pageant here where we're grading you. No, it's just simply wins and losses. It's a short menu, as Rob Parker says. It's a short menu, wins and losses. That's it in the NFL. College football, they lost to this team who beat this team. That was a bad loss. They only won by this many. In the NFL, it doesn't matter. It's a lot like golf. For golf, right? It doesn't matter how ugly it looks. If you shoot a low score, people don't ask you how you got there. If you par a hole, it doesn't matter if you had to, chip out of the high grass. It doesn't matter. All that matters is that final number for each hole and the final number for the round. They don't ask you after, how many fairways did you hit? Did you have to two putt? You have any three putts out there? Doesn't matter. It's the final number. That's the same with the NFL. You could have beaten quarterbacks. If you have 10 wins, it's considered a good year and you're going to the playoff. So this time of year, just win, right? The overused cliche of Al Davis, just win, baby. Doesn't matter how it looks. Last night, neither of those wins were pretty. But you're playing outdoors on beat-up fields in cold elements with adjusted schedules, at least for one of those games. Guys missing games. Doesn't matter. Just find a way to win. And if you go back and you look, the quarterback play this weekend, not very good. A lot of bad quarterback plays on Sunday if you look at the stat lines. Pretty ugly. Last night, all four quarterbacks, pretty bad. September, October, that's when you see the offense racking up points, the elements helping out, allowing you to throw it all over the place. This time of year, it becomes a little bit more about a physical approach, running the football, playing defense, handling the elements. Next man up, you're going to be missing pieces. You can't rely on your quarterback just going out there and throwing for 300 yards every week. This time of year, you have to find some other ways to win. And last night showed that in both of those games. Now, I gave you my circle of trust earlier, using the circle of trust from Robert De Niro in Meet the Parents. But using that circle of trust from Meet the Parents, which teams do you truly trust in the NFL? I gave you mine earlier, and there aren't a ton of them. In the AFC, I would simply say the Chiefs, the Colts, and the Patriots I would put in the circle of trust, but maybe like a second tier. They don't have top tier status in my circle of trust. They're a little bit like Ben Stiller's character, who he was in the circle of trust, right? But you knew De Niro still didn't trust him. And rightfully so, with everything that went wrong in that movie, which was kind of like the Patriots Saturday night against the Colts. They had the block punt. They had the turnovers. They fell behind early. They got punched in the mouth. They had the penalty on the missed field goal. The Colts then make the next opportunity. That's like Ben Stiller. Anything that could go wrong would go wrong in that movie, Meet the Parents. He's letting Jinxie out. He's burning down the house, smoking cigarettes on the roof. All right, loses the race home in the cars from the restaurant, trying to get home before they discover that he had a fake cat that ripped up the house. Spikes the volleyball and gives the bride the bloody nose. It's just one thing after another. He couldn't catch a break. That was New England on Saturday. So the Patriots, they're kind of, one foot in, one foot out, doing like the hokey pokey right now in the circle of trust. Because I trust them, and I'll trust any Belichick team playing good football, but we know Mac Jones has a ceiling. He's limited. I only trust really those three in the AFC. I think the AFC is a little more top-heavy. I think the NFC is a little more wide open. In fact, when you look at the standings, I mean, the NFC, if the Rams win tonight, they'll have five teams, five of the seven playoff teams as of now with 10 wins. And I do think the Rams win tonight and get to 10 wins. So when I look at the NFC, I trust the Packers. You certainly trust the Buccaneers. I do trust the Rams. I think they win tonight. They get to 10-4. That ties them with the Cardinals for that division. And I just think based off of talent on paper, the Rams have the second. The Rams and the Buccaneers, granted Tampa Bay is really beat up right now, but those are the two most talented teams, I believe. And then I trust the Niners. They're much like the Colts, just of the NFC, playing better football. They got the weapons. They got a good coach. They got a quarterback that you don't fully trust, but if he gets the pieces, some help around him, he can play well, right, in his elements. If you don't ask too much from Garoppolo or Carson Wentz, I trust San Francisco this time of year. They were in a Super Bowl a couple of years ago. I don't trust the Cardinals anymore. Not the way that Cliff Kingsbury and Kyler Murray have played in the second half of seasons, and especially December's. I do not trust them. It's more than just that loss to the Lions. It's the fact that they slip this time of year every year, so I can't trust them to win the big games right now. And the Cowboys are like the Patriots, one foot in, one foot out. I trust that Dallas' ability to right the ship offensively. As of right now, that offense has not been good enough to get them far enough in the playoffs. Plus, you factor in Mike McCarthy makes some ridiculous decisions each week. That's going to cost them in a big spot. And the defense needs to win a certain way. But they have the potential. They have the ability. If they can figure some things out here in the final weeks, I would fully put them in my circle of trust. And that's how I would break it down for these final 3 weeks heading towards the postseason. In the AFC, I think it's just those three teams, the Chiefs, the Patriots, the Colts. In the NFC, a few more teams, the Packers, the Buccaneers, the Rams, the 49ers, and then the Cowboys are kind of half in, half out like New England. I think the NFC is a little more top-heavy. But you look around the league and people may say like, oh, there's no clear-cut favorite this year. The NFL is having a down year. I don't think so. I think a lot of it is there's a lot of good teams that beat up on one another. But in the AFC, you have only three teams with a losing record. Three out of 16. And in the NFC, again, if the Rams win, it's not better. And you'll have a couple of teams, as of now, miss the playoffs despite having at least 500 records. I think there are a lot of good teams. Maybe there's not a great team, but it's also not a lot of bad either. It's just a lot of good teams on level playing fields beating each other up. How do you separate those teams? Which ones do you trust more than the others? I just gave you my list. Teams in the NFC. And my little Super Bowl window would be eight teams right now in the final month of the regular season. You can always join the conversation, 843- 721-9500 to give us a call. Let's go to the phones. Alex is with us. Alex, what's going on? How are you?
Hey, Bob. Hey, Luke. How you doing?
Good. What's up?
Two questions. One, do you think in the future for the college players, do you think our high school players will have more power in recruiting over the recruiters themselves when they decide where they want to go versus how the recruiters will decide which player they want?
Yeah, I think so. I think we already saw that this year when the number one recruit went to Jackson State, and in large part, you would assume
right.
because of the million-dollar name, image, and likeness deal that's tied there because of Deion Sanders' connections.
Yeah.
And Jimbo Fisher said something along those lines on the Feinbaum show, but Jimbo also acknowledged that this has been happening for years. It's just now easier, and it's in the public light. But for years, you had this name, image, we couldn't call it name, image, and likeness. You had players getting paid to go to certain schools. But now it's more out in the open. It's known. And the difference now is the negotiation is probably more so with the players because they have more opportunities and freedom, where back then, you know, it was the schools had to be shady enough to offer the money and you only had certain opportunities where not maybe every school was willing to pay a kid. Now, you know, you could get these name, image, and likeness deals just about anywhere. And then Lane Kiffin was complaining about this, that you have kids holding some of these schools over a barrel saying, well, this school, I can make this much money. How much can you offer me? So I do think we're moving in that direction where, yeah, the ball will be in the court of these players, that there still are certain schools that you want to go to, like in Alabama, to be developed and go to the NFL. But if certain guys have other priorities in terms of name, image, and likeness, you can hold some coaches or programs kind of over a barrel to get as much money as you think you can and make your decisions that way.
So with that said, how does Clemson compare this year? It's got to be disappointing in the recruiting class compared to others, although – Bobby seems to think it's good. It was a good year, but I don't think it is. You're a Fanto guy, but I don't think it was a good year compared to a lot of years. He thought, but anyway, what do you have to compare this year to a lot of years?
Yeah, it's a down year for Clemson recruiting from the overall aspect. You know, they finished ranked. Or I shouldn't say finished because we still have the period in February, but they're right now ranked number 24. On 24/7 Sports. So they've actually gone in the wrong direction since actual early signing day, because you could still sign some guys in the days afterwards. They're number 24. But I know somebody had messaged the show last week and brought up a good point. It depends how you want to look at it, because it's quality versus quantity. In terms of quality, well, let's first look at quantity. Quantity is low, only 12 commits. That's a large reason why they're number 24 in the rankings. But then if you want to look at quality and you look at the average of the players, only 12 commits, but you take their average for Clemson, it's at 92, which I believe is fifth. So if you went off of average type of player they're bringing in, it is number five in the country. So still in line with recent years. However, if you want to look at overall the number of players they're bringing in, the number of holes they're filling, the amount of depth they're adding, for comparison's sake, Texas A&M, the number one recruiting class, had 27 commitments, more than twice as many Clemson. So Clemson, on average, is bringing a lot of talent. And then you also get into the gray area of, well, you know, which team has more scholarships to offer, which team has more starters to replace, or just more spots in the roster to replace. You get into the weeds, and I don't know off the top of my head, you know, those numbers to compare the different schools. But Texas A&M, their average is also 94. Clemson's 92. So just to compare those two schools, just for the sake of comparison, Texas A&M is bringing in over twice as many recruits and, on average, a better player as well. So that's the big difference. So it depends what you value or how you want to look at it. Based off of the average type of player being brought in, Clemson's still top five. Based off of the total players being brought in and how we look at these full recruiting classes, I mean, they're in the 20s, which is not good for them. It's also the smallest recruiting class they've had in years. It's the lowest rated they've had in years. But it also depends, you know, in terms of needs. What do you need from this particular recruiting class? How many guys do you need? How many do you need to try to step in early on? How many positions of need do you have? But overall, I think it's disappointing for Clemson, especially you consider the fact that they had three kids out of IMG, you know, three top 100 kids decommit after the Venables news. That right there is a big shot. You know, that's a big hit that you take, losing those three talented players. And they all ended up going to three teams, separate schools, but all to a team that's in the playoff right now. So it speaks to how good they are that they're going to some of the best teams in the country. You could have those three guys all on defense. That makes a big difference for your class. Yeah, the recruiting's down for Clemson. That's what happens when you lose, in this case, coordinators. If you lose a head coach or even assistants, because the assistants are doing a lot of the recruiting. When you lose some of those guys in an offseason, it hurts your recruiting. Nebraska, remember, they fired all of their coordinators, all their assistants under Scott Frost, and Nebraska finished with the worst recruiting class in the Big Ten this year because it's a lot of the assistants that are actually going out there and making those connections and lining up the recruits. And once they're no longer at the school, the recruit is thinking like, well, I don't want to go there anymore. I don't know any of these other coaches. The guy that was recruiting me is no longer there. So when you lose the coordinators for Venables, he was recruiting those three kids from IMG. He leaves. They decommit. That really hurts Clemson's recruiting class.
But this is also a natural cycle in college football, because once you have a successful team like that and, you know, you get all the big recruits for a while, but then they start thinking, you know, I might go somewhere else where I might stand out more.
Yeah, we'll see. I mean, this is the first time in over 10 years that somebody not named Alabama or Georgia has the number one class. It's Texas A&M. But then you have Alabama at number two and Georgia at number three, so they really haven't fallen far. But those two have dominated recruiting. You know, college football in general set up for these dynasties. The NFL is not. The NFL is set up for parity. And it's why college football has always been dynastic, and the NFL has always been, you know, unpredictable. In the NFL, the team with the worst record gets the better draft pick. You get the better waiver claim. You get the easier schedule. You help out the teams that struggle. The teams that have the most success, you get the worst draft pick. You get the toughest schedule. You get the last waiver claim. And in college, there's no sorts of adjustments like that. When you're the best team, it allows you to get the best players, and it's kind of never-ending. For Clemson, though, certainly a down year so far in terms of recruiting. How big of an impact will it have back in the top five next year? You know, it remains to be seen. We'll find out. And then if you want to compare Clemson to South Carolina, this is the other thing, too, where you can really dive into these numbers in recruiting. When you look at just the overall rankings, South Carolina's 20, Clemson's 24. So you would say South Carolina had a better year. And it depends, again, how you look at recruiting. Maybe you would feel that way. But again, then you go to the average. Clemson, the average recruit they brought in, has a 92 ranking. South Carolina has an 87. So it goes back to quality versus quantity. South Carolina brought in about twice as many players, but Clemson had twice as many blue chips. What would you prefer? Do you need more guys to fill out the roster, or do you just need more talented guys? Right, fewer players, but more talented. That's, you know, pick your poison. That's a different, we can have that argument, and you can figure out what you would prefer. But simply based off of the recruiting rankings, right, Clemson's number 24, but then you look at the average and the blue chips, and they compare more favorably to some other programs. It just depends on needs for a program or even just desires, what you would prefer for your program. And Clemson overall, though, it is odd to see them at number 24 after they've been in the top 10 in recent years.
And then also you have to remember all these, you know, they call them blue chip recruits, but it's just like with being drafted into the pro sports, they're going on their potential, like one of our callers said, you know, potential and hope. Same way with college recruiting, because oftentimes some of these big-time recruits, it's going to turn out they peaked in high school or they're going to end up having to leave college for any other reason, you know, particularly for academics.
Certainly. It's like, you know, you never know. You can't predict an 18-year-old. That's why Clemson fans also point to the fact that they developed a bunch of, you know, three-star recruits. Isaiah Simmons was like a three-star. Hunter Renfro was like a no-star. Right, so that's what they point to. Now, Clemson's still doing a good job of blue chips, just not the number, not the overall number of players coming into their class. But last year, they were the number five recruiting class. This year, right now, they're 24, and it's still way too early, but for next year, they're currently sitting at number 27. So it's just not the direction you obviously want to be moving in. They've been the number one recruiter in the ACC in recent years. This year, so far, they're number three. And it goes back to what we were talking about yesterday, that if nothing else, that gap is certainly closing in the conference in terms of you're not dominating as much in the players coming in compared to the rest of your competition as you were in the past. And especially now with Cristobal arriving in Miami, I'm sure he'll do a good job. Appreciate the call, though. Took us on a whole little tangent there. Coming up, we'll talk a little baseball on this Tuesday in December. The New York Mets made a hire. And if you're an Atlanta Braves fan, right, you always have to keep an eye on what the other competitors, what your division rivals are doing. I got some strong thoughts on the new guy leading the New York Mets that if you're a Braves fan, maybe you'll be interested in. We'll get to that coming up. Plus, we still have to get to our Tuesday Top 10. We'll do that as well. It's the Morrow Midday Show right here on ESPN Radio.
Now back to the Morrow Midday Show on ESPN Radio.
All right. Christmas, just like the ones I used to know, where those treetops listen and children listen to hear sleigh bells in the snow, the snow. But then I am dreaming of a white Christmas.
Coming up, some thoughts on the new manager in the NL East. We'll get to that here in the Morrow Midday Show with Luke Morrow on ESPN Radio. I looked up the most covered Christmas songs of all time. The most versions that you have out there. This number can't be true. I have to be... I don't know if this is exactly what they mean. But number one is Silent Night. Silent Night came out in 1818. It's one of the older Christmas songs we have. In fact, on this list, it looks like it's the fourth oldest amongst the most covered songs. According to Spotify, there's 26,000 versions. That is crazy. 26,496 versions of Silent Night. Number two, though, White Christmas, which you just heard there, came out in 1940. That has been covered 20,721 times, apparently. Now, of the 20,000 versions, I can confidently say that one right there is my favorite by the Drifters, and really just because it was used in Home Alone. That's the way to my heart. If your song was in Home Alone, I'm all for it. My favorite version of It's Beginning to Look a Lot Like Christmas is Johnny Mathis' version, because that's used in Home Alone 2 when Tim Curry discovers that the credit card is stolen while Macaulay Culkin is going around in the limo. That is a great scene. He's watching the Grinch, and then the Grinch smiles, and it lines up perfectly with Tim Curry's smile, and the light goes on. Oh, I love that scene. So that's my favorite version of It's Beginning to Look a Lot Like Christmas, Johnny Mathis, which is a great version. I don't see that on this list. Number three for most covered songs, Christmas songs that is, Jingle Bells. Came out in 1857 originally. And when I say came out, really written. Right back then they weren't releasing albums. So it was written in 1857, Jingle Bells. It's been covered 19,000 times. The Christmas song is number four, 1944, 13,000 times. The First Noel, 1833, 12,000 times. Then you get Winter Wonderland, Santa Claus is Coming to Town, Have Yourself a Merry Little Christmas, Joy to the World, and Away in a Manger are the top 10 most covered Christmas songs of all time. But if it was at Home Alone, that's the version I prefer, and that one was from the Drifters, so I love it. I think we've done a top 10 list before, but along the way I've sprinkled some of my favorite Christmas songs. Someday at Christmas, Stevie Wonder is right up there, number one, number one and a half. There's some great ones. That one by the Drifters makes my list. It's one of my go-tos. I have a short list of songs I listen to this holiday season. Darlene Love, Christmas, Baby Please Come Home. Great song. And that was used in one of the Home Alone films as well. Darlene Love has a couple of good Christmas songs. So we get the news. It became official, technically became official in the last 24 hours, that the New York Mets are hiring Buck Showalter. Now, normally, we may not be thinking of baseball this time of year, especially when they're in a lockout. And normally, you may not even care so much about the Mets, but, you know, they are a rival of the Braves, and it's important when they hire a manager and they make a big move, you got to see what everyone else is doing in the division. And even though these teams are in a lockout, the managers are not part of that because they're not part of the players' union. So it is a little odd, and I understand why it is. It's just a weird dynamic that you can't make any free agency moves, but you can hire coaches. You can adjust your front office right now. You can adjust your coaching staff. And the Mets finally hired their manager, Buck Showalter. Now, growing up in the Northeast and having plenty of Mets fans as friends, and even I worked for the organization at one time, I pay close attention to the Mets and also just, you know, like the sports talk in New York. I grew up on that, on WFAN, so I always pay attention to that stuff. And I know it seemed like a lot of Mets fans, this was the guy they wanted, Buck Showalter. Now, if you're a Braves fan, how concerned should you be that Buck Showalter is with the Mets? It's like if you're an SEC fan, right? If you're a fan, we were talking about the SEC earlier and some of the good coaches they brought in. Now that Brian Kelly is hired, how concerned should you be that LSU, you know, just got a good coach in that division? It's the same idea. If you're a Braves fan, how concerned should you be that, oh no, they hired Buck Showalter? Personally, I'm not the biggest Buck Showalter fan in terms of his managerial prowess. I think he's a little overrated. If you go back and you look at Showalter's resume, he is Good Luck Chuck. Good Luck Chuck, that movie with Dane Cook, back when Dane Cook was like the biggest star in comedy, and then who knows what happened, and he fell off the planet. But he came out with Good Luck Chuck, and the idea was, you know, he was cursed, so women would date him, and then they would find their husband the next relationship. The relationship with Dane would not work out. He was Good Luck Chuck. So then women, realizing this, wanted to start dating him because they knew after him they would find their soulmate, their husband. It wasn't about Dane Cook. It was about the next guy. And I think that's the case here with the Mets. Keep an eye on the next hire, not this hire. Why? Because Showalter was a manager at the Yankees. That was his first job. They get rid of Showalter after 95. They had that disappointing loss in the playoffs to the Mariners after the 95 season. They bring in Joe Torre. And you know Joe Torre now, but that's revisionist history. When they hired him, the papers called him Clueless Joe. And Torre, that very first year, 90, you probably remember it too well, they win the World Series and they start the dynasty of the 90s. First year after Showalter's gone. Showalter winds up in Arizona. New expansion team. And he deserves credit for having early success in Arizona. But couldn't get over that hump. So they fired Buck Showalter in Arizona after the 2000 season. They bring in Bob Brenly. What happens? First year under Bob Brenly, they win the World Series as an expansion team 5 years in. New manager. So you could say, you know, just like we say with Tony Dungy and the Buccaneers when Gruden won with Dungy's players, and we say this about a bunch of teams, Barry Switzer won with Jimmy Johnson's team. I guess you could give Showalter some credit for these teams winning the World Series after getting rid of him. But I think it's even more important that he couldn't get over that hump. New manager comes in right away, has immediate success. Then Showalter goes to Texas, becomes the Texas Rangers manager. That's when they had A-Rod. Texas Rangers had a top five payroll, finished in last place. They were a perennial last place team with Showalter. He gets fired in Texas. His last managerial stop was Baltimore with the Orioles. And I can't take away much. I'll give him actually props for the Orioles job because we've seen how much of a disaster they've been without Buck. And they weren't much better before Buck. And he kind of turned them around. And the only good years the Orioles have had really since Cal Ripken's retirement were with Buck Showalter. So I'll give him props there. He did a pretty good job there. But you may remember the thing that stands out most is when he refused to use his closer in the wild card game for the Orioles and they got knocked out. He's won, I think it's one playoff series, maybe not even. He's been a manager for about 20 years and has had very little success in the playoffs. Under 500 in the playoffs. He's a 500 manager all time. So Mets fans are really excited. And if you're a Braves fan, you're thinking like, oh boy, is this finally going to be the guy who comes in and turns the Mets around? Because the Mets haven't been to the playoffs in 6 years, despite all the moves they made in the payroll. And you got Steve Cohen, and they're all, you know, happy and excited. But it hasn't equated to enough success for them. And now they had Buck Showalter. And if you talk to a Mets fan, they think this is the guy that's going to get us over the hump. But I'm telling you, if you're a Braves fan, I don't think this makes much of a change. I don't think this comes across your radar. It's not much of a ripple. Go hire Buck Showalter. I'm not worried about it. I wouldn't be, and I'm not a Braves fan. 20 years for Showalter as a manager, and he's 9-14 in his playoff career. I believe he won one, maybe two playoff series in 20 years. Overall, 500 record, under 500 in the playoffs. And as I said, good luck, Chuck. The Yankees won the World Series the very next year after getting rid of him. The Diamondbacks won the World Series the very next year after getting rid of him. So if you're the Mets, you shouldn't be so excited about this hire, but maybe the next one. When you move on from Showalter, whoever you hire next, maybe he'll be the guy to finally bring you another World Series in New York. By the way, for Buck, maybe this is the trick. Maybe this is the right move to go. That if you look old from a young age, it'll look like you never age. See, that's the trick. You may look old early, but then as you get older, it'll seem like you're never aging. I love Curb Your Enthusiasm. Larry David has looked the same pretty much going back to his days on Seinfeld 25 years ago. And so you watch Larry and you think like, wow, he hasn't aged a day in his life. But that's because he was already gray and bald, you know, when he was 35. So he looked old then, and now it's catching up to him where he looks young now. He's like 70 now. And you watch him and you think like, wow, he's looked the same for 20 years. That's an old trick he could pull on people unintentionally. Buck Showalter, when he was with the Yankees, he was in an episode of Seinfeld when George wanted to have all the cotton uniforms. He looked the same then as he does now. And looking it up, when he was the manager of the Yankees, I didn't even realize he was that young. He was in his 30s. He looked 50 back then. And so now he's like 66 years old, introduces the manager of the Mets. He looks exactly the same. Morgan Freeman is kind of like that. He's looked exactly the same over the years. Maybe a little grayer now. I'm trying to think of other celebrities who haven't looked like they've aged in years because, like Eddie Murphy, he never looked old for his age growing up. But there are certain guys that they have not changed whatsoever. And usually it's because they looked old back then, and then they've just stayed looking old as they get old moving forward. So that's the one positive. So if you're somebody who's like balding in your 30s or you're going gray, yeah, it may seem unfortunate. Right now you look around with your buddies and you think like, man, I look so much older than them. They all have their hair. I'm losing my hair. The good news is if you fast forward 20, 30 years from now, we're going to look at all those other your buddies of yours and think like, wow, he's looking old, right? He's lost his hair now. You got that out of your way. And we look at you and say, oh, he hasn't changed in 30 years. He looks good for his age. Because you looked old when you were young, so now you look younger when you're older because you have looked the same. That's Buck Showalter. That's my aging theory. Buck Showalter has looked the same his entire career. And therefore, you look at him now and you think you forget that he's like almost 70 years old because he hasn't changed in 30 years. He looks the same now as he did at his 30s. Problem was, he was looking old in his 30s. Now he's just kind of looking his age. Long story short, for Buck Showalter, I know Mets fans are really excited. I had to be the wet blanket for some of my buddies. They were texting over the past week, oh, we're going to get Buck. I was telling, you know, the guy hasn't won anything. He's had a lot of talent over the years. The Yankees, the Diamondbacks with Schilling and Randy Johnson, the Rangers with A-Rod and a top five payroll. The one exception was the Orioles. He got more out of that team than he should have. But his other three stops, he underachieved. So, I wouldn't be overly excited. If I'm a Braves fan, it's not like I'm all sorts of concerned. They didn't just bring Joe Torre out of retirement. It's Buck Showalter. Braves will be fine going up against that. We'll wrap up your Tuesday. When we come back, we'll get to our Tuesday top 10 before we go to close things out today as we get ready for the holiday coming up, Christmas at the end of the week. It's the Morrow Midday Show right here on ESPN Radio.
Spend lunch with Luke.
Attention campers, lunch has been canceled today due to lack of hustle. Deal with it.
On the Morrow Midday Show.
Santa Claus goes straight to the ghetto. Hitch up your reindeer and go straight to the ghetto. Santa Claus go straight to the ghetto. Fill every stocking you find. The kids are gonna love you so. Leave a toy for Johnny. Leave a doll for Mary.
Fun a funky finish to your Tuesday afternoon here on the Morrow Midday Show with Luke Morrow on ESPN Radio. A little James Brown Christmas music. Don't forget we have Citadel basketball tonight. Coverage will begin somewhere around 6:30 to 7, depending on how long it takes for the first game of the tournament. And the Citadel will tip off against Manhattan. And then just in terms of a programming note, we'll be with you tomorrow leading right into Gamecocks basketball. Assuming that, I mean, nowadays, I don't know, these basketball games in college, you don't even know. It's like last year all over again. Last year, I remember with the Citadel, you didn't know until you actually got to the arena. Like, are we playing tonight? And the Citadel had a couple of instances last year where they were on the bus going to the game and got the call. Like, yep, game's off. And they have to circle and turn around and come back. So you don't know. And unfortunately, in college basketball, Frank Martin was, you know, complaining about it, and I think rightfully so, but we're seeing games get postponed, not even postponed, forfeits. The Big East, they're making teams forfeit. Seton Hall, ranked 15th in the country, had to forfeit last night. So there you go. Take that loss. See how that affects you in the rankings. It's crazy. So anyways, South Carolina is supposed to be playing tomorrow, and we'll take you right up to the coverage. Begins at 2:30 tomorrow. So we'll be with you until 2:30 tomorrow, and then we're off for Christmas for the Morrow Midday Show. I can't speak to the other shows, but I know Thursday and Friday, we're off. And we'll be back with you after the weekend. So long story short, we'll be with you for most of tomorrow, and that's the final time we'll hang before the holidays, and then we'll catch up after the weekend. And by the time we come back on the air next week, you'll get ready for South Carolina and Clemson bowl games and the college football playoff. So next week's an exciting week in college football in terms of actually going out and playing games. Hey, if you ever miss anything from the show, you can always catch it on demand. Search ESPN Radio Charleston however you listen to your podcast, the full show available in podcast form. And don't forget, you can take the Morrow Midday Show with you wherever you go by simply streaming us online at charlestonsportsradio.com. You can also take the Morrow Midday Show with you through TuneIn Radio, your smart speaker, or our free app. Go to the App Store and download our app, ESPN Charleston, in the App Store. To listen to the Morrow Midday Show or ESPN Radio Charleston from anywhere in the world. And, of course, the podcast also available through the app or online at charlestonsportsradio.com. Appreciate listeners checking in from at least 7 different states on this Tuesday afternoon as we head towards the holiday season. And I'm sure it's a busy week for you. Maybe traveling. You may have people over getting those final gifts. I went to the store yesterday, or maybe it was Sunday. Went to the grocery store. And oh, it was great to see. They had the Panettones on the shelves. I don't know how many people are even familiar with those, but we have it's our family tradition. We have them for Christmas. It's our Christmas breakfast every year. It's an Italian cake. Although I got to tell you, the Panettones I saw at the store here did not have the chocolate inside. It was just the fruit filling. That's not good enough. You got to have the chocolate. And what a it's the best breakfast you'll ever have. I may have said dessert. That's the breakfast on Christmas. It's a chocolate cake. It is so good. One of the things I look forward to most this holiday season. You have one for Christmas Eve. You have one for Christmas Day. Oh, it's delicious. And I saw the Panettones on the shelf this week at the grocery store, even here, and I thought, oh, yeah, it's that time of year. And underneath, I saw the platters for the cookies. And, of course, that's another classic for my family's Christmas. Somebody's got to bring the Italian cookie tray for dessert. But the problem is, not all the cookies are that great. I'm sure you've had these cookies before. You ever get those leaf cookies? Oh, those ones. No, thank you. Leave those out. And I think really overdone are the ones with the cherry in the middle. Those are okay. You know what also is really overdone? The Christmas cookie that has played itself out. They call them, well, if it's with peanut butter, it's the peanut butter blossom. But a lot of times it's got the Hershey Kiss in the middle. You know what I'm talking about. It's just a regular cookie, but you drop the Hershey Kiss in the middle. Those cookies are so overplayed. Everybody makes those this holiday season. I'm done with those for a Christmas cookie. Now, if you put some peanut butter in there, that's not so bad. You give me a peanut butter blossom. See, there's a big difference. You give me a nice peanut butter cookie with a Hershey Kiss in the middle. That's not so bad. Now, I'll be honest with you. Those are tough to eat. How do you take a bite out of a cookie with the Hershey Kiss? How do you approach that? Do you try to bite the Hershey Kiss right down the middle? Because the top of the Hershey Kiss is so thin. That's tough to do. Do you then turn the cookie sideways? Do you just rip the Hershey Kiss right off the cookie? Because that's how I usually go. And I really don't care about the Hershey Kiss. We've all had Hershey Kisses before. Get those out of here. That's not special. And I go for the peanut butter cookie. I rip the Hershey off, and sometimes I don't even eat it, and I just have the peanut butter cookie. But those cookies in general played out. Now, I am going home for the holidays. And I could tell you, growing up, I don't know if the pandemic or even just people moving around and you get older, I don't know if that's changed things. But my mother always had a cookie exchange with the neighborhood, the people of the neighborhood. Every holiday season. And I remember one in particular. We would always have to get out of the house. We didn't want to be around. All the women would come over. They exchanged their cookies. My brothers, myself, my father, we'd go out to like a sports bar, go watch whatever sports are on that night. Get out of the house for the night. And you don't want to be around when they're all exchanging their cookies and they're having their wine and everything. So, and of course, everybody would make, that's why I think I have such a disdain for those types of cookies. Everybody would show up for this cookie exchange with those same blossoms. It's just bland. I don't even know what flavor it's supposed to be. I don't know if it's even a sugar cookie, the ones that weren't peanut butter, and they have a Hershey Kiss in the middle. And just because you're adding the Hershey Kiss, you think it's so special. Oh, those cookies are it's so overplayed. But I remember one year in particular, we had to stay home because the Vikings were on. It was the first year of Thursday Night Football, and it was the first time our Minnesota Vikings were on Thursday Night Football against the Green Bay Packers at Lambeau Field, and it was a big deal this time of the year, right around Christmas. And we actually had Fred Smoot on the show last year, and he was the one, he had a pick six in that game, and he tried to do a Lambeau leap, and I remember talking with Fred about that a year ago. But what a terrible game it was. It was something like 9-7, the Vikings lost, and it was horrendous, and they had 100 yards of offense, much like last night, and Tavares Jackson was terrible. And I remember the cookie exchange going on in one room, and we were sitting in there miserable watching the Vikings lose at Lambeau Field, and that's my greatest memory of the cookie exchanges. But this time of year, I always think of the great cookies. Now, the best cookies that you can get this holiday season. I don't have a full 10 for you. You know, we always do a Tuesday top 10. It's hard to come up with 10 good cookies for you. But the best cookies, in my opinion, and let's be honest, right? When it comes to cookies, the definitive list comes from yours truly. I'm biased. Me personally, anything with coconut is the best. You get a nice coconut cookie, bring those over to wherever you're going. You're going to your uncle's, you're going to your aunt's, your cousin's, just a friend, you're having a friend's holiday for Christmas, you show up with the coconut cookies, oh my goodness, those are the best. I'll also tell you, very underrated are the almond cookies. Now, when you get one of those cookie trays, they usually come with the almond cookies, if they're done right, especially if it's an Italian cookie tray, and it doesn't look like much, but they're different colored almonds, and they slice them up, and they put them on the cookie. You've seen this cookie before, I'm sure. It is so good. Very underrated. Doesn't look like much. They're usually left on the platter, and I appreciate it. My family members may not go for them, so I eat them all. The almond cookies are very good. This also comes from somebody who loves Almond Joys. So you can understand why the coconut cookies and the almond cookies are top of my list. Because what is an Almond Joy? It's just simply almond chocolate and coconut. So that's right up my alley. The holiday sugar cookies can be appreciated as well. Just a classic sugar cookie, but you put it in the shape of a snowman or of Santa himself or a reindeer. Just a classic old sugar cookie. And the chocolate-dipped shortbread cookies are also fantastic, where half of them are dipped in chocolate and the other half is just a normal, classic, you know, shortbread cookie. Maybe put some sprinkles on there. That's the tops as well. That's the Mount Rushmore of holiday cookies this time of year. And indulge. Your New Year's resolution can be going to the gym and losing some of those LBs. But in the meantime, eat all the desserts you want. You've earned them this year. Have those Christmas cookies. Just make sure they're coconut or almond in nature. Before we go, quickly, let's go to the phones. John is with us. John, what's going on? How are you?
Hey, Luke. Merry Christmas.
Merry Christmas.
I had a comment on the cookies. I'm a sugar cookie guy. I'm not real big on cookies. But remember, you might be too young, but you used to do a Christmas trees, you know, shaped with Christmas trees, and they had like a green icing on it.
Uh-huh.
And they had these little, they'd have this kind of little, like little pearl things for the ornaments. And they were, I guess they're made of sugar or something. I guess they're edible, but they would like, could crack your teeth if you bit into them. Do you know what I'm talking about?
Yes, I think I do.
It's just little tiny like balls, you know, that look like ornaments that are on the cookie.
Right.
But I used to hate those things. Yeah, you'd like to have to spit them out like watermelon seeds or something.
Yeah, some of the cookies can be too much, and we got to run, but appreciate it, John. I tell you what, one of my aunts actually does the very decorative cookies, and not just for the holidays. She'll do like college graduations. She'll make it in the mascot of your college. She does great. It's crazy what she can do with cookies. But with that said, some of them are so overdone that you lose the whole idea that it's more about the art than it is the flavor. And that's another big no-no this holiday season. If you're making cookies, they may look really nice. You want to do the Christmas tree. You want to do the ornaments. Just make sure they taste good. And a lot of those cookies are very plain. They're just sugar cookies with some sort of icing on there. And they don't taste the best. They may look really good, but they're hard to bite into. They're much thicker. They don't have the most flavor. That's another good tip this holiday season. And maybe it's too late to save you, but when it comes to the Christmas cookies, just keep it simple. Doesn't matter how they look. You don't need to make some crazy Christmas tree. Just make sure you make cookies that taste good. And we'll leave you with that on this Tuesday. If you ever miss anything from the show, catch it on demand. Just search ESPN Radio Charleston however you listen to your podcast. Life is a series of hellos and goodbyes. For now, we'll say goodbye. We'll say hello again tomorrow at noon. It's the Morning Midday Show on ESPN Radio.